Appoint for me a place. Please be seated. I feel that one of the most important hours in the Christian's week is the Sunday evening worship hour. And I don't think that that's a peculiar, or that that estimate of it is peculiar to me. I believe that you share that same estimate of the value of the evening worship hour. There's something about it that's, it's good. And it seems like that when we're here in the evening, it's just us home folks together. That's good, and I'm thankful for you. The evening worship hour was challenged in New Zealand, among other things, that those independent brethren of ours set about their minds to look into, and they wanted to know if this was just an American custom that we met on Sunday evening. And I said, well, if you can get to heaven without it, go at it, but I don't believe you can make it. I think it's part of your growth and part of the things that you need. And they looked at it real seriously and said, we agree, and they're still meeting on Sunday evenings there also. We're going to be looking tonight for a few minutes at motives. Motives behind the rejection and execution of Jesus. Now, last Sunday night, we looked at some things that are more concrete and tangible. We looked at people. And we looked at the main characters in this drama, this tragedy of the execution of Jesus. We looked at Pilate and Herod and the religious leaders of the Pharisees and Sadducees. But we looked at them primarily just simply in their role as people who were contemporary with Jesus in history. We didn't attempt to draw out of their actions any motives or read into them any motives. We simply looked at the actions themselves for the purpose of establishing some type of historical continuity or obtaining some kind of historical perspective, and in hopes that we would become more acquainted with simply the historical record and thus get a feel for Jesus of Nazareth and where he was and with whom he associated and how he was done in, they thought, by his enemies. But tonight we're going to see if we can't delve a bit behind the scenes and look at the motives behind the actions of those people. You and I do not share the historical setting of those people. They were there, cast in a role that they did not ask for. They were there and called upon, they were, to make decisions regarding this man, Jesus of Nazareth, who had invaded their time. And they were put on the spot in a way that you and I are not. They were asked to actually make a judgment and make a decision about this Jesus. We are asked in a similar way, but it's not in the same way. Today, however, we do share with them, not just in a similar way, we share the identical challenge to our motives. Their motives for rejecting Jesus are identical with those who reject him today. I came across an interesting note that was, I received it in the mail from a friend of mine just this past week. It's entitled, Israeli Judge Author Argues That the Jews Wanted to Save Jesus. And this is the way the article goes. It came out in the Little Rock Gazette, June the 14th, 1975. The Jewish leaders involved in the trial of Jesus at the home of the Jewish high priest were really trying to save Jesus from the Romans. Now, can you believe this? Listen, when the high priest tore his garments during the trial, it was because Jesus said all the wrong things and would surely die for it. The Roman governor, Pontius Pilate, with nothing to gain by condemning Jesus, was given no choice in the matter because Jesus claimed to be the divine king. And then this writer of the article explains that these explanations are those of Haim H. Cohn, or Khan, a member of the Israeli Supreme Court and an expert on Jewish and ancient Roman law. And Judge Khan discussed this position sometime prior to June the 14th, 1975, in Chicago, in the presence of a group of theologians there. He explained the ideas in his 1971 book, that makes it 6 years old, or 5 years old, now out of print, entitled The Trial and Death of Jesus. But I thought that was very interesting, to find a man who would actually argue that the attempts of the Jewish people in the time of Jesus in his trial was not to kill him, it was to actually try to get him rescued from the Roman authorities. And I was amazed at how a man could take the only extensive and complete record of those events and exactly go diametrically opposed to the obvious conclusion that you have to draw if you read those events in the records. But we're going to be looking tonight at these motives. We want to look at the motives of the people. There were motives behind what they did. There were two different kinds of people involved in the trial, in the execution of Jesus. There were those that I want to refer to as the masterminds. And there were those to whom I would like to refer as the manipulated. For example, the Jewish rulers were the masterminds behind the murder of the Messiah. There's no way that any person who can read and understand words can deny that the Jewish people, Mr. Khan notwithstanding, the Jewish leaders were actually those who masterminded the execution of Jesus the Jew from Nazareth. And then there were also those, and I will mention only one tonight, and that is Pontius Pilate. He was not the mastermind at all. He was what you'd have to call the manipulated. He didn't ask for this thing. It was thrust into his lap, and he had to do something about it. But both the masterminds and the manipulated had motives that stood behind their actions that I want us to look at tonight. And though you and I, historically speaking, are not called upon to make the identical judgment concerning Jesus that the Jews did or that Pilate did, you and I are in a similar way or in an identical way asked to clear up our motives and reveal to ourselves and look at our motives for our acceptance of him or our rejection of him. The Jewish instigators, as I'm going to refer to these people, found themselves grappling with Jesus Christ on a battlefield. The battlefield where Jesus came to a head-on confrontation with the Jewish people was always the battlefield of truth versus tradition. That's where they always seemed to come down to just simply a knockdown, drag-out battle of the wits. It always revolved around truth versus tradition. Jesus was forever clashing with these people at the point of tradition. Because you see, these people were so tradition-bound. They had a tradition about their traditions. And they had traditions that were grandsons of traditions. And they had traditions that they didn't know where they came from. But because they were traditions, these people held on to it. And oh, how they loved those traditions. But you know what? You love traditions too. It just tickles you to death to snuggle down real comfortably in a real nice, warm, well-worn tradition that you can feel comfortable in. That's right. And that's why Jesus clashed so with them. In the book of, It's in the book of Luke, chapter 5. There's a very unusual passage there. The Jews came to Jesus one day and they said, "Why don't your disciples fast?" They said, "John's disciples, they fasted, and the disciples of the Pharisees, they fast. Why don't your disciples fast?" And Jesus said, "Well, how can the friends of the bridegroom mourn while the bridegroom is with them? When he's taken away, they'll mourn, but how can he mourn while they're still with him, while he's still with them?" And then he told two parables. One about putting a piece of new cloth on an old garment. He said, "Don't do that. the new piece won't match the old, and actually when it shrinks, it's going to take away from the old garment, and the tear is going to be worse than it originally was. And then he spoke also about putting new wine into old wineskins. And he says, you don't put new wine into old wineskins, lest when the new wine ferments, it will burst the skins, and you will waste or spill both the wine, and you've ruined the skins. He said, new wine is for new or fresh skins. And what he was saying was, don't try to measure what I'm saying in the context of your previous religious understandings. Jesus was saying, I am bringing to you some new understandings. And you must not try to force these new concepts into your old, used, dried up, petrified skins. Now, what he was saying, I am presenting to you truth. But they were so tradition-bound that he likened their, I wish I knew this word, sclerosis is the noun. I don't know whether sclerotize is a verb or not, but we'll just, their hardened shell of tradition-bound legalism had them so confined into their preconceived ideas that they could not understand these new ideas that Jesus was bringing. For example, in John, the third chapter, Jesus spoke to Nicodemus about a new birth. But Nicodemus couldn't understand him because he was trying to pour this teaching of the new birth into an old wineskin. He said, how can a man be born when he's old? Can he enter a second time into his mother's womb and be born? Jesus said, Nicodemus, that's not what I'm talking about. And he said, how can you, a teacher of Israel, if you don't understand these things that I've told you, these earthly things, how will you believe if I tell you heavenly things? And then in John, the fourth chapter, he met a woman of Samaria, and she had the same problem. She was asking Jesus about worshiping in Mount Gerizim or Jerusalem, and Jesus said, the hour is coming and now is when neither in Jerusalem nor in Gerizim will men worship God. For God is spirit, and those that worship him must worship in spirit and truth. There's that new wine that Jesus was bringing. But they were trying to pour it into old wineskins, and it wouldn't be contained. Consequently, every time Jesus spoke of truth, their traditions would not let them understand the truth that he was speaking. And on and on and on he would go presenting truths, and they couldn't understand them. When he talked about things on the Sabbath, he would ask them, is it right to do good on the Sabbath? They were offended because he would do good to people on the Sabbath day. They were worried about whether or not it was right to eat eggs laid by a chicken on Saturday. That's one of their big hang-ups. They felt like you couldn't eat those eggs because she worked awful hard to lay that egg. And that was on Saturday, and that's a no-no now. Just hold it until Sunday. And they wouldn't eat it. They wouldn't let you comb your hair on Saturday. Not that it was wrong to comb your hair, but they were afraid you'd find a gray hair and you'd pull it out, and that's work. That's a no-no. Now, these are actual cases. These are case histories. They were worried about tithing, men, Annas, and Cummin, and they had gotten it so refined that they would count out 9 seeds for themselves and 1 for God. And they spent their time over this thing, you know, worrying about 9 for me and 1 for the Lord. While they were talking about all of those things, Jesus Christ was talking about the new birth, the worship of the eternal God as a spirit who had to be worshipped in spirit and in truth. He was talking about these magnificent, timeless, eternal themes of truth, and they were just butting head-on into the preconceived ideas that had been formulated by the Jewish people and so circumscribed by their own traditions. Well, the people couldn't understand Jesus, and so they rejected him. Jesus said, you really know how to reject the Word of God in order to hold on to your traditions. He says this in Mark, the 7th chapter. Well, did Isaiah speak of you, he said, you hypocrites. And he talked about how they reject the Word of God and hold on to their traditions. Now, you might think on the surface of the matter, why did these people act like they did toward Jesus? When it came to the Sabbath day, they said, you couldn't be a man from God because you don't keep the Sabbath day. And it says they persecuted him all the more because he not only broke the Sabbath, but he claimed to be God's son, thus making himself equal with God. So there was this constant battle back and forth, but it was always over this thing of truth or tradition. And whenever their traditions were assailed or were confronted by the truth that Jesus taught, they just clamped down and said, we're not going to accept it. Now you might say, well now, that was because of their religious convictions. Looking at motives a moment now. That you say they did this, their motive was religious conviction. Well, that's reasonable on the surface to think that. Because after all, these people were charged with keeping the orthodoxy. They were charged with keeping things right. And Jesus himself said, now, the scribes and Pharisees, they sit in Moses' seat, and whatever they tell you to do, you do it. And Jesus placed these people under the authority of the reigning authority. He said, you do whatever they say do. Just don't do like they do, because they say and don't practice. They preach but don't practice. But Jesus Christ found himself always at odds with these people when it came to their traditions. Was it because of religious conviction that they acted like they did? No, it wasn't. Well, what were their motives? Number one, pride. These people were very proud people. They loved, Jesus said in Luke 20, they loved to walk around in long robes. Now we're talking about grown people. Grown men and women, particularly here men. Grown men. They love to walk around playing religion. They love the chief seats in the synagogues. They like these salutations in the marketplace. And they like the best seats at feasts. That was their thing. Boy, they felt that was it. As far as they were concerned, if they could get that, you could have the other things. They wanted that position of prominence. John, as you read tonight in the verse there, says they love the praise that's of men more than the praise that's of God. Now, there's a good pride and a bad pride. You ought to have a pride in the way you look. You ought to be clean. You ought to have a pride in your work. But that's not the kind of pride these people had. It didn't stop there. These people were proud in a selfish kind of way. You've heard of people saying that man would actually sell his mother. These people to whom Jesus addressed himself in his personal ministry, these people actually had sold their mother. In Mark the seventh chapter, Jesus there says, you actually contradict the word of God in order to keep your traditions. He said, let me give you an example. The law says, honor your father and mother, and he that speaks against his father and mother shall die the death. But you say, whoever says to his mother or father, that wherewith you might have been profited by me has been given to God. It's korban. And you say, if any man says that to his mother or father, if he recites this formula, that liberates him from any responsibility of taking care of his old mother and daddy. He said, you really have done it upright. Well, do you know how to contradict or break the commandments of God in order to keep your traditions? These people were that selfish that when you look at their, you think, well, my, that must be out of religious conviction. Rubbish. It wasn't religious conviction. Jesus Christ knew their problem. These people were selfishly proud. And it's pointed out again in John the 11th chapter, where when Jesus Christ was at the peak of his popular ministry, the leaders of the Jewish people gathered themselves together and said, look at him. Just look at him. He's doing a lot of things. He's doing a lot of signs. And if we just let him go on like that, the whole nation is going to believe in him. And then the Romans are going to come and take away our place and our nation. You know what this our place was? Their position. They said that the Romans would come and take away our place. And it was this was what it was that was so outstanding about their rejection of Jesus Christ. They were feeling threatened, and their tradition-bound status quo, when Jesus of Nazareth came and taught eternal truths that had such far-reaching aspects and such far-reaching consequences, these little petty seed pushers were down there counting their seeds, and whenever they looked up and saw Jesus doing all these mighty works, they felt threatened, and as a result, they retaliated. And it was so obvious to them that even Pilate himself, it says that Pilate knew that it was because of envy that they had delivered him up. Envy. Motives? What were their motives? Not religious conviction. But you know, at religious points, wherever religion comes to bear on our lives, motives are hard to determine. because they get all tangled up with religious sentimentality. And we don't quite know how to sort out our motives. A young lady came forward this morning stating that she had had wrong motives. And it was read from the pulpit that her motives for coming forward in times past had been wrong. Well, she was involved in this thing of sorting out her motives. I spoke this morning for about an hour to a group of young students here in this congregation to help them see what their motives were in their being baptized. And they wanted to sort it out. But when we get down to religious matters, motives become clouded and fuzzy. If you don't believe it, turn to Acts, the 19th chapter in your reading sometime and read about the silversmith. What was his name? Demetrius? Demetrius the silversmith gathered all the people of like art together when Paul was preaching that there are no gods made with hands, and their sales record had taken a dive. Demetrius got all these people, these religiously concerned folks together, and said, "Now look at him. Not only is our trade going down the drain, but our esteemed goddess Diana, her prominence and her preeminence, it's being threatened, and the whole of Asia worships her, and she's at the point of being dethroned." Watch out, Demetrius. By your own mouth, you've let it out what your motive is. You're not concerned about Diana. You're concerned about your own pocketbook. But when it comes to religious matters, we find ourselves hard pushed to identify our motives many times. When you boil this thing all down, those who were the instigators, those who were the masterminds of this thing, they masterminded the execution of Jesus Christ because of the simple fact that their traditions would not stand for someone speaking the truth to stand up and challenge their position. They felt insecure. They felt assailed. They felt attacked. So they just simply lashed out and rejected him. They killed him. It boils right back down to selfishness. But look again. Look at Pilate. He didn't instigate anything. He was manipulated. I imagine Pilate wished many times that he was home in bed. He didn't want to judge this case. Pilate got caught on a different battlefield, though it's similar, but it's different. It has more of a street ring to it. Pilate got caught in a dilemma that you and I can more easily identify with, for the simple reason that we more easily identify with the street life and our own practical everyday living than we do with theological questions of lesser or greater importance. We're not all that great theologians. I'm not. But I can identify with this man Pilate, who was manipulated. He didn't instigate anything. He was manipulated into it. And you know where the battlefield was? Not truth or tradition so much. It was over popularity or right. Right versus popularity is where Pilate got caught in the neck. You see, he had a choice to make. The Jewish people, the popular demand, the cry of the day was, "Kill Jesus of Nazareth." That was what the popular call was. But Pilate knew he wasn't guilty. Pilate knew that he had not done anything worthy of death. And Pilate then made, I think, a gallant effort to stop this foolishness and to release Jesus. But nevertheless, he was caught in this bind. He was caught between popularity and right. Have you ever been caught there? I think you have. I wonder what guise it came to him under. Oh, it came to him under the guise of political expediency. You know, there was a riot forming. Did you ever see a bunch of rioting people? Did you ever see a bunch of rioting Jews? I'm telling you, when they get a cause under their belt, you better watch out. Pilate knew them well. In fact, he had come in from Caesarea down on the seacoast where his house was. He had come in for this week of the Passover just simply because of the fact that he knew that the Jews were a volatile, explosive people. And he had come in there to keep the peace. And lo and behold, just as he expected, here was a situation that was primed to explode. Like nitroglycerin, and he had to just juggle them real gently and easily. And they wanted him to make this decision. And it boiled down to whether or not he was going to do what was right or what was popular. Political expediency? Yep. And if it had been kept there, I suspect that Pilate could have gone home with a fairly clear conscience, thinking that his motives were right in saying, "Well, now, after all, it's my responsibility, you know, to keep the peace in this city. And I felt that it was politically expedient to put this man to death in order to keep the peace." That sounds pretty good. And after all, he said, the Jews themselves had already judged this man. Their own nation of people had said that it was expedient for one of them to die rather than the whole nation perish. You know, the high priest had already made that judgment. Political expediency. Well, perhaps. There was one other option that he had that he did not use. He could have said, all right, be quiet, everyone, not a word, everyone, I want to make an announcement. Then he could have dispatched a whole battalion of Roman soldiers out among the populace, among the throng, and he could have said, I'm going to make an announcement, and the first one that opens his mouth in opposition to it, I'm going to cut your head off. He could have said that. But he didn't have the internal, intestinal fortitude to buck the popular voice. But watch what broke his back. It wasn't this political expediency thing, in a sense, that initially on its first basis. It was when they drug into this issue that of self-preservation. You see, Pilate had already made himself clear. He had already finally taken his stand, and he said, in a sense, I'm not going to hear any more about it. He said, Herod has not condemned him, I've not found anything wrong in him, and I'm not going to do anything but beat him and let him go. But it says they absolutely would not hear of it. You know what broke his back? They said, if you let this man go, you are not Caesar's friend. Anybody that makes himself a king speaks against Caesar. Now, Pilate had ample evidence that this was not true. Jesus had already told him, my kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my soldiers would fight, my disciples would fight. He had sufficient insight into the nature of the whole trial. It says that he knew that it was because of envy they had delivered him up. And then he had a perfectly good political excuse. He was not of his jurisdiction. Jesus was a Judean, was a Galilean, not a Judean. Oh, he was born in Judea, yes, but he was living in Galilee, and Pilate could have gone to court saying, well, now this man is he's a Galilean, not a Judean. He's under Herod's jurisdiction. Take him over there. I will not judge the case. So he had ample evidence. He had sufficient insight. He had a perfectly good excuse. But when the people put him in this tourniquet and they started screwing down on him and said, if you let this man go, you're not Caesar's friend. And boy, the ramifications from that continued long and loud in his ears. Not Caesar's friend. Anybody that makes himself a king speaks against Caesar. All he needed was for somebody to say, Caesar, that man let an insurrectionist go. And the Bible says, Luke records it in Luke 23:23. It says, their voices prevailed. Why did he do it? Selfishness. Look at the motives now. They're the same. Those who were the mastermind and the instigators, their motive for rejecting Jesus Christ was selfishness. Pilate, who was actually manipulated, when he was caught in something that he did not ask for, he was also found to operate off the basis of selfishness. Both of these groups of people wanting to preserve their position, both of them wanting to maintain their sense or their platform of security. But be gentle with them. We find ourselves in this same position. Selfishness will keep you and me from following Jesus too. In fact, that's really the only motive that you've got for rejecting him, selfishness. There's ample evidence. You've got sufficient insight. There's no reason to reject him. But selfishness will cause you to. You know why? Jesus dealt with motives in Luke the 19th chapter in verse 27 when he told about the man who had, the king or the prince who had received a kingdom and was on his way into the far country to receive this kingly power. But it says, he told in the parable that his citizens hated him. And they sent an ambassage after him saying, we don't want this man ruling over us. And when Jesus touched that, he touched the nerve that sparks the rebellion of every person who turns his back on Jesus then and now. We don't want him ruling over us. And even you and I would rather be our own God. We don't want anybody ruling over us. what are your motives tonight? You ought to judge them. You ought to be very unrelenting. Be relentless in your quest for complete objectivity in your motives if you possibly can. Why are you where you are tonight? But the main thing I want you to see some of the give and take that's involved when it comes down to people being called upon to make a decision about Jesus. I think you first ought to settle it in your own heart as to why you've rejected him or accepted him, whichever the case may be. But then if you've accepted him, I want you to be prepared to look into the lives of people and help them understand their motives for a possible rejection of Jesus. Whether it's like Simon Peter, who at that moment just did not want Jesus ruling over him, and he denied him. Oh, he wouldn't call it that, and he wouldn't say it, but that's what happened. In practical effect, Jesus was rejected by Peter because Peter just simply did not and could not trust himself that much to a man that it was a threat to his life. Or Pilate, whose security was threatened. Or Judas, who sold him for cash money. Or the Jews, whose position of prominence and honor was threatened. How many times have we, when Jesus has stood before us, shackled and bound and standing there, crowned with this thorn, how many times have we let our love for popularity and our love for prominence or our love for the popular voice and approval of our associates, how many times have we let that cause us to deny him? And when our tradition, if there be those that you're holding to religiously, in this wrangling entanglement today where brother is assaulting brother and a battle is being pitted against other brethren in battle, whenever this happens in the church today, you know much of it has to do with just simply what your tradition is. It may be whether it's a one cup or a located preacher or whatever it may be. And I often wonder, what are our motives in the defense of these things? And even if you're defending truth many times, your defense of the truth can even be approached with the improper motives. Why am I preaching here today? What am I doing standing behind this pulpit? What's my motive? And I'm not judging your motives. I pray God every day that I live, Lord, cleanse me from any ulterior motives. Let there be nothing in me but purity. I don't want to be ulterior in my motives. And we all need to do that. Tonight, there may be those here who have not found themselves able to surrender themselves in the only real area that Jesus demands. You know what it is? Jerry spoke on it last Wednesday night. If any man would come after me, let him deny himself. Take up his cross and follow me. What are your motives? If we're not careful, we'll find ourselves, though not identifying with them historically, we find ourselves identifying with them very exactly in the motives that we have. And whenever you and I come down the road of life and we reach that crossroad where we're called upon either to submit to Jesus or reject him, whether it be at the crossroads that is labeled truth versus tradition, and our religious convictions are at stake, or whether it's at that crossroad that says popularity versus right, the issue and the motive that's at stake is whether or not you're going to operate out of your own will for your own good or for your own self-interest, or whether you'll operate out of the off the basis that Jesus is Lord of your life. We don't want this man ruling over us. But I'm saying for us here tonight, I believe that we do. I believe that I want Jesus ruling over my life. I hope and pray that that's your same conclusion about yourself. You're given an opportunity tonight to respond. Will you look at your heart? I can't look at your heart. You look at your heart. What are your motives for being where you are? Will you be kind enough to yourself to lay yourself on the altar of self-sacrifice for Jesus of Nazareth? The time won't be long, you mark my word. It can't be very long when someone is going to come and call an end to this mad existence that the world has gotten itself into. You know who I believe is going to be heading that call and who's going to be leading the army? Jesus of Nazareth, sitting on a white horse whose name is the Word of God. I believe he's coming. then all the motives will be judged. He who judges the reins and the hearts is going to be sitting upon the throne. Let's be ready for him. May God bless us. Let us stand and sing.
Let me hide myself in thee.